Welcome to Ballistic Radio. Join us as we discuss hard-won self-defense lessons, as well as the information you need to survive a violent encounter. Listen as armed professionals, industry experts, national champions, and gunfight survivors answer all your firearms and self-defense questions while exploring your rights and responsibilities as an armed citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Surefire, the professional's choice for suppressors and illumination tools. Surefire, America's beacon of freedom. And now, here's your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Surefire, the professional's choice for suppressors and illumination tools. Surefire, America's beacon of freedom. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com. Get the latest behind-the-scenes info, photos, videos, other stuff at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me, the Danger Pixie Actual, Melody Lauer.
Namaste.
Okay. So that's four.
Now, do you know what language that is?
I'm gonna know in a second.
Are you Googling it? Mm-hmm. That's cheating. You have to guess. You have to at least give me a good guess.
I don't know.
All right.
So, I don't. Is yoga? Is yoga a language?
No, yoga is not a language.
All right. Anyway, so. We're doing a Facebook user episode. Apparently, one of the questions, I didn't know it, was, what language is that? So, but before that, guess what?
What is that, John?
This segment brought to you by Lucky Gunner and Federal Premium Ammunition. Whether there was a firefight, or you do, in fact, want to worry about that little guy, you need more ammo. And when it's time to restock, you can't beat Federal Premium Ammunition at LuckyGunner.com. With a shipping department that's always moving at 88 miles per hour, if I order a case of American Eagle from Lucky Gunner on a Thursday, it's at my doorstep ready to shoot before the weekend starts. Head to LuckyGunner.com today to check out their in-stock lineup of Federal Premium Ammunition. And remember, unless you're falling down the stairs or drowning, you can never have too much ammo. Does that one work better?
I don't know. I'm going to have to think about that one. You kind of sprung it on me.
Yeah.
Falling down the stairs. What would that have to do?
If you're carrying a bunch of ammo and you fall down the stairs, that seems like it'd be extra pointy.
It depends on how you're carrying it. Could break your fall.
No. Oh. So, it's a Facebook user episode question thingy.
Indeed.
And you've got the questions.
You have them too.
I haven't pulled them up yet. So actually right now. All right.
So I guess I'm starting with a question for you.
And just delete the questions after you ask them so that we don't have more of the.
All right. Okay. So from Kyle Goley, who asks a lot of good questions, by the way.
He does.
Why are J-frames still relevant and 357?
And 357 out of one?
Yeah.
Two-part answer there. They're still relevant because they do a thing that not many other things do well, and that is get neglected inside of pockets.
They do that well?
Yeah, actually they do.
They get neglected well?
Well, I mean, so if you compare like a small pocket auto, and those are oftentimes barely running. I mean, they'll run, and they'll run okay, you know, on a range, flat-footed, you know, whatever. But when they start, you know, if they get...
Collecting lint
and pocket detritus and drying out and stuff like that, they don't typically, not always, typically don't work as well. Whereas the J-frame can fit inside of the pocket roll or the ankle roll or, you know, whatever, and be more forgiving of neglect. That's not to say they're more reliable. And I want to be very specific there because J-frames have their own set of issues. But they seem to, inside of that role, work a little bit better. As far as 357 out of one, no thank you.
right.
Yeah. You're not.
I have one of those.
No.
Ugh.
Have or had?
I have.
Do you have another one?
Oh, no, that's right.
Yeah.
I sold it.
Yeah, I know. I know who you sold it to. But it's, Yeah, it's you're not gaining enough to make up for the horrible increase in wrist shattering recoil and stuff like that. And honestly, I run subcaliber J frames at this point for backup guns. You know, 22 Magnum, 22 long rifle, because I like having the increased capacity and I like having the lessened recoil, so I can actually hit things with them.
I think a good episode to listen to in regards to this is Caleb Skiddings when he talks about revolvers and the learning curve that, yeah. that goes with learning them and when you are most effective with them.
Yeah. But in general, are they still relevant? Yes. Why are they still relevant? I think we just covered it. So I guess let me see here. I'll ask a question because you... You asked the last one. From Hiram Grissom, recognizing the difference between a shooting hobbyist and a defensive force hobbyist, how can we help bridge the gap between the two from a mindset perspective and also a skills perspective?
Well, I guess the first question I would ask in return is why do we want to? Because there are a lot of people who, for whatever reason, get into the hobby that is shooting and that is self-defense. And, you know, if you're just enjoying shooting and that's just your hobby, there's no necessarily super duper reason why you need to make use of force and that kind of stuff your hobby, as long as you are at least aware of it and you've at least tried to get yourself up to a proficient level. I mean, you and I both know, John, people who are phenomenal shooters and they are hobbyist shooters and they really enjoy it.
Yeah.
But they are not
self-defense.
They're
shooters.
Not self-defense nerds. And in fact, a lot of them don't even carry guns when they're not, you know, competing or they're not having fun. And that's okay because that's not their goal. That's not their focus in life. And that's okay. Now, what we, I believe, would really want from them is to, if they are going to carry a gun, if they're going to make that part of their life, that they are going to at least have the cursory basic knowledge as far as, you know, use of force laws, you know, what constitutes deadly force and all that kind of stuff, which hopefully they, as a responsible individual, have sought out on their own. But if not, then I think it's just a matter of kind of encouraging them along that line and being that advocate for, okay, well, you're carrying this gun and you're really into it and that's awesome. Maybe we could look at this avenue. And sometimes just looking at a different avenue of shooting, especially for people who are hobbyists, gets them into the outskirts. And a great example of that would be Tim Herron. You mm-hmm. know, Tim Herron got super into shooting as a hobby. And then once he started looking all of the little pieces surrounding shooting, he got into self-defense as well. Now, he's still mostly just a shooting hobbyist, but he's by no means ignorant about the use of force and the laws and all that kind of stuff. It's just not his primary focus. And I see that a lot with extreme hobbyists. And a lot of people, if they'll get into like IDPA or something like that, then they start kind of bunny trailing down that use of force continuum. And it they play very well, nicely. But at the same time, I'm not going to, if someone's just purely in it for the shooting and the enjoyment of it, I'm not going to try and ruin that for them.
Well, and that's something that I think a lot of people miss. Is that this can just be a fun hobby. It doesn't need to, I mean, I enjoy my job. It's not really my hobby anymore. It's a profession, but like making this work and making this focus solely around, you know, violent things happening to people and preventing those violent things from happening has certainly lessened my overall enjoyment of this. And if people want to keep that, it's just a recreational thing, you know, as long as they're mitigating as much risk as they're able to as far as, you know, handling practices and stuff like that, then yeah, that's cool. You know, it doesn't...
I would kind of equate it to someone who's into boating and having someone else be like, you need to know about patrolling, you know, waterways and, you know... the weekend boating enthusiast who just wants to go on the lake with his family and friends and splash around in the water and have fun, it shouldn't have to have someone beating them over the head and be like, well, you need to know about all these, you know, if that's what they want to kind of look into, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, well, I guess, oh.
Go ahead. I was going to say, we got like a minute left before the break, but.
I'll ask you and you can think about it.
Well, ask me quit.
What force-on-force training have you participated in? And more importantly, what equipment or training practices have you changed as a result, other than more lumens, by Mike Doyle?
Okie dokie. That is a good question that I will think about. I guess we'll go to the break now just because I don't want to answer that question in 30 seconds. But anyway, we're answering your questions. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Surefire, the professional choice for suppressors and illumination tools. Surefire, America's beacon of freedom. This segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 9/11 scatter gun since 1977, a legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories, as well as the new EDC X9, which offers discriminating shooters 1911 match grade accuracy, superior ergonomics and concealability with modern service pistol capacity and reliability at www.wilsoncombat.com. So do you want to reread that question real quick, just so that if people are tuning in now?
Yes. It was from Mike Doyle, and it was, what force-on-force training have you participated in? And more importantly, what equipment or training practices have you changed as a result other than more lumens?
Do you need water? You're sounding a little scratchy.
I have my stuff.
A lot of force-on-force training. So that's – we'd be here a little bit. Essentially, as far as what that gets for you or what practices I've changed, as soon as you start having your will opposed inside of these environments, it's really – It's really enlightening as far as your gear decisions and, what you decide is important, what you decide is not important. It's funny, you know, like I go and take ECQC, and then all of a sudden a fixed blade center light knife seems really important because I'm inside of that environment. It is very important, you know, or I go take EDP. And it's like, man, I really need to carry spray. And you start seeing highlighted these deficiencies in, well, if I find myself in this situation that I've not properly considered, it can go really bad for me, if that kind of makes sense. So I guess for me, the biggest number one takeaway for me from Force on Force has been working on my own verbal agility. Which is something that I'm not as good at as I would like to be as far as inside of an encounter, like the pre-assault portion of the encounter. And then having spray on me to utilize before it gets to be a gun problem. You know, that's kind of the big ones. I've actually, oddly enough, stopped carrying a centerline knife the last couple of months, just because I need to get a new sheath for the one that I carry, and I haven't gotten around to it yet. And, you know, that's just kind of where I'm at right now, and that might change. And I reserve the right to change my answer in the future.
Well, and it's interesting you say that, because – and that just goes to illustrate the differences of priorities that people can take away from a particular training event. And to me, a centerline fixed blade knife is – almost as important as the gun, because for me, whenever I have been in a training environment where a retention struggle happens for the firearm, all of it has been with a larger, you know, more stronger individual, and I always end up losing my gun. So having that force multiplier in addition to the gun has been very, very crucial for me.
I said more stronger. I don't know. But you're never going to get in a fight with someone that is your size or smaller.
And that's what I'm saying.
Unless you're attacked by, like, an angry child.
Yeah, and that has happened.
Well, yeah, you know what I mean, though.
Yes.
And that's the other thing, too, is that you need to be making decisions based off of your own level of training, your own physical ability, and your own situation, and not just because I think something's a good idea for me or Melody thinks it's a good idea for her. It's just it's all going to be very, very much tailored to you as an individual. So here's an interesting question from Ross Hick, who asks a lot of really interesting questions.
He does.
Have you ever taken the same class and come away with a completely different take from each other on something? If so, what was it? I need to stop and think about that for a second.
So when I was putting that question into this, I was thinking about it. And, you know, I mean, when we take training together, we talk about it a lot afterward. Yeah. And I was actually really trying to think if there was ever a time that we came away with two totally radically different perspectives on a class. Because let's face it, usually the perspective of the class is painted for you in a lot of senses. Like, this is the goal that we're trying to achieve. This is where we're going to go with this. The only divergent to that, I think, would be something like ECQC, where it's more of an audit and it's more of what you are taking away from the class. It's not necessarily you are taking the class to get to a particular goal.
Yeah.
I think maybe the closest that we've ever gotten as far as taking a structured class together and getting different things was maybe some of Fisher's classes, both his handgun and his long gun, because we were both going into it looking for different things, maybe. What do you think?
Huh.
Because there have been handgun classes that we've gone to where I'm just trying to get to that level or, you know, work a new skill. And you're trying to refine something that you already know how to do. Or like, for instance, when you were transitioning to the dot, you're like, I'm going to focus on this dot. And I'm like, I'm going to go over here and I'm going to focus on trigger control. Yeah. You know, so – but that's more a goal outcome than it is us perceiving something different.
Yeah, I don't – so the thing is, and like for, you know, Melody and I do disagree on certain things.
A lot of stuff.
Yeah, it's happened. What's funny, though, is like we usually fight it out until we don't anymore, at least historically. That's been how it's gone. As far as like going to a class and taking away something different, I don't think so. I mean, I can't ever think of a class that like I really enjoyed that you've didn't enjoy, and I can't think of a class that, you know, we've both gone to where like, oh, this was awesome or this was not awesome, and we had different opinion on that. So no, I mean, for as different as our lives are, we obviously have very similar philosophies on training and how training should be conducted and stuff like that. Otherwise we wouldn't be able to teach together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that answers that.
I
hope it does.
I think so. Let's see here. Ty Holm, is there any evidence to show whether appendix carry is safe or not safe in a car accident, assuming the seatbelt was worn?
There's no evidence that there's no statistical evidence because that study has not been done. But as far as there's a lot of anecdotal evidence, as long as you've got the seatbelt staged right. So if you leave the lap belt down where it should be across the bridge of your hips, over top of the holster, and then have the shoulder belt either over the grip of the gun or tucked behind the gun, you turn out okay. I've spoken with multiple individuals and even been involved in car accidents myself carrying that way, no issues. If you move the lap belt up behind the gun to where it's no longer across the bridge of your hips and it's across like the soft squishy part, you run a severe risk for secondary injury from the lap belt. The way seatbelts work, and especially when like pre-tensioners fire and stuff like that, they are designed to interface with bone, not soft tissue. So I think that's the important part to consider when you're thinking about all that. Anything?
Yeah, no, the few people, I probably haven't talked to as many people as you, but the few people that I have talked to who have either been responding to scenes where people, and that's the other thing too, is one, not a lot of people carry guns appendix. Two, they don't get, I'm saying like they get into car accidents and that we see, you know.
Okay.
Right. I
disagree with that statement.
Well,
somewhat,
what I'm saying, though, is like the number of car accidents that we see where one, a gun is even present.
Right.
And then two, the gun is carried appendix versus
right.
in the, you know,
right.
center console or whatever, is really low statistically. So we don't have the number of the data just yet as far as like. But
well,
for
been...
the most people that I have talked to, it has been completely inconsequential considering the other mechanisms of injury.
Right.
You know, if you get a head-on with a semi and half your head is gone, having your gun carried appendix really didn't matter there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Tarek Nwad, what are your thoughts on the self-contradictory position that so many in the industry take on gear versus skill? In one breath, claiming skills are greater than gear, but at the same time, pretending anyone not willing to make the total lifestyle and dress change required to carry all the current gear du jour is just not serious enough about self-defense.
I think those...
And we are friends with people that do this.
Yeah, we are. I understand it. I do understand it. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I do understand it. Because when people find what works really well for them, they become, for lack of a better word, missionaries. And they get really passionate about it. And they start, especially if they've struggled before. And they get into this mindset that everyone should do just like I did because look at how much it helped me and I just want to help you. So I completely understand that. And taking yourself out of your own personal experience and leaving that personal experience behind and looking at the personal experience and needs of someone else is a difficult thing to do. And so I don't want to call those people hypocrites. I don't want to call those people clueless. I don't want to call them... But I would encourage them to take themselves out of their own experience.
Right. I have more to add to that, but
yes.
We have to go to break. So we're answering your questions. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Surefire, the professional's choice for suppressors and illumination tools. Surefire, America's beacon of freedom. This segment also brought to you by Surefire. Know your target and what is beyond it. But how can you really know your target? By shining a really bright light at it, and that's where Surefire comes in. From the new 1200 lumen EDC L2T handheld or 500 lumen EDC L1T handheld to the 1000 lumen XH35 or the 1500 lumen M600DF scout light, Surefire can make sure you never have to yell, "Aziz, light!" ever again. Surefire, the professional's choice for suppressors and illumination tools. Remember, you can get 20% off everything at the Surefire.com web store except batteries and suppressors by entering the discount code AzizLight, AZIZLIGHT, no space. So, before the break, we were talking about the contradictory positions that some take as far as, you know, skills are more important than gear, but if you're not carrying the right gear, you get killed on the streets. Here's something that a lot of people in the training community don't want to talk about. Oftentimes, in the typical self-defense counter, I'm not saying they're all typical, but in the typical ones, just having the gun with no training, know anything other than the thing that makes loud noises will get you through the self-defense encounter. You might get hurt. You might not get hurt. It'll get you through it. You'll survive it most of the time. What training and gear and other things, you know, other soft skills allows us to do is handle more complex problems in shorter amounts of time while operating under greater deficits. And if you are going to the trouble of doing one thing and it requires much, you know, very little trouble to do additional things that set you up for greater success in those situations, it makes sense to me to do that. That having been said, I'm not going to hold it against the guy that, you know, has to wear a suit and tie to work, and if he gets caught, loses his profession if all he carries is a 5-shot J-frame. You know, he doesn't need to wear cargo pants and baggy t-shirts and carry an arm or a Glock or anything like that. That's just, they're different things. So I don't know how we get people around that, but it's, you know, like Claude Werner said a couple months ago, his number one advice to instructors is, hey, go get a real job and try working one for a month or two and see if you have the same thoughts and ideas about what you can carry or not carry.
Well, and start thinking of your students, not as students, but as clients,
right.
And tailoring your instruction to them and their needs instead of trying to make copies of yourself. I think that's pretty important there. All right. I had a question, and it kind of scrolled away here. From Henry Miller, how can someone with a spouse who does not express any interest in self-defense begin to have the conversation about self-defense with that spouse?
What are you willing to do? And that's the first question you ask. What are you willing to do? I'm not willing to do anything. Well, you had the conversation with your spouse. I mean, and that's it. And the fact of the matter is that we cannot convince people to take an interest in this stuff. That's a decision they have to make on their own. And every time we try and force somebody into doing something they don't want to do, it's not doing anything at all. So my number one advice would be don't pressure anybody into doing anything that they're not comfortable doing. And as far as this field goes, because what you're going to end up doing is turning them off from it so badly that whatever concessions, whatever thoughts you would have been able to eventually get them to come to on their own, never going to happen now. Let's assume that they're willing to, I'm willing to look at information, you know, then maybe send them to a seminar. You know, here's what violence looks like. Send them to a William April class, you know, the lecture portion of an Unthinkable. I think that's an amazing place to start as far as like, oh, wow, these people are not like us. And it happens a lot more than I think it does. You know, send them to our class. We have a 4-hour lecture about here's what violence towards children and families looks like. And here's, you know, the realities of it. And here's how you recognize it and you know, avoid it. And it's not gun-centric at all. Just stuff like that. You need to just be a vehicle for them to find their own relevancy inside of this community. And if there isn't any for them, then there's never going to be. Don't buy them a gun. Don't make them go take a shooting class. Don't do any of those things, you know, that people usually do, forcing, like, just like the question we answered before. Don't try and make a clone of you. It's not going to ever happen.
I think something that is useful, though, is, for instance, if you are going to have a gun in your home, and most people can understand this and be reasonably accepting of it, is being like, hey, you know, I've got this gun in my home. I know you're not into guns, but if I'm ever gone, if I, for whatever reason, become incapacitated and you're left alone with this firearm, I would like you to just come to a basic class with me just so that you know what to do. And a lot of times that completely unassuming, this is just so that we're kind of on the same page as far as equipment is concerned, can be a doorway, as long as you are doing it not, you know, I mean, be sincere about it. And that is a legitimate concern. If you do have a gun in your home, I strongly believe that everyone in that home should have a cursory knowledge of it and be able to secure it if need be. But, you know, that's sometimes a good place to start as well.
Let's see.
It's your turn, sir.
So we've already answered at least one question from Ross Hick. It might even be
he asks good questions.
Yeah.
He does.
Here, I want to ask you this, Melody. Do you think categorizing shooters by class in competition, either by gender, experience level, or skill, can be detrimental to overall skill development? If so, when?
See, I kind of am on both sides of the fence here. On some ways, I think it's very helpful because in most competition kind of situations, you are shooting amongst your peers, and there's always going to be people who are a little bit better than you, and there's always going to be people who are a little bit worse than you. And you can kind of feel confidence building that you're getting close to the top of your bracket or your group, But at the same time, there are those who think, oh, well, I've made it to the top of B class. And so, therefore, I've topped out on my performance, and I'm just going to be happy to be here. And I think it becomes worse when you start getting too many accolades or too much praise for being where you are when there's so much further that you can go. So if it's kind of like that everyone gets a trophy kind of a thing. If you shower too much, like, yay, I have arrived, on someone who's kind of still at a relatively mediocre level, they're going to be more comfortable to stay there than if you're like, so what, you're just a C class or whatever. You know, there's a whole lot more above this. Why don't you go? One of the best things that I ever heard was when, you know, Ben Steger said, you're a good shooter. You got B class in you. I said something about wanting to be top five at my local range. And he said, you are setting your bar way too low. And that's the thing. I think a lot of us set our bars way too low when we could be looking a lot further.
Remove the yoke of low expectations.
Thank you, Gabe White.
Yeah. To quote the excellent Gabriel White, remove the yoke of low expectations.
What are your thoughts, John?
My thoughts are there is a minute left in the segment, and if I say what I really think here, I'm going to make a lot of people mad. But you know what? I don't care. Let's stop telling people that suck that they don't suck. That's real simple. I'm not saying that we need to knock them down in the dirt and be like, you know, you're awful and should feel bad. But it's like, oh, I did awesome. It's like, well, you did better for you, but you know, this is still not an acceptable level of performance, and you can do better. And I think that oftentimes in trying to be encouraging to people, what we actually end up doing is patronizing them and completely removing their ability for growth. Just my thoughts on it. But we're answering your questions. We've got to go to break. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Surefire, the professional choice for suppressors and illumination tools. Surefire, America's beacon of freedom. So, you had a follow-up to the last thing I said.
Yeah, I think that just simply classifications, like, you know, IDPA, sharpshooter, whatever, or A-class, B-class, C, that doesn't necessarily put any expectation, like the raw classification is nothing.
Yeah.
It's just a classification. It's not, you're not praising, you're not getting praised, but you're also not getting beat down.
Here's
where you are. Here's the levels. Here's where you are. And so I want to be careful not to demonize the classification system just because some people abuse it by making it mean more than what it is, if that makes any sense.
They either place too great of an emphasis on a lower classification or place too great of an emphasis on a higher classification, frankly. You know, and it is what it is. And I agree with that completely. It's your turn.
It is. It is indeed my turn. Zach Smith said, I recently had a conversation with a friend of mine, and the question came up of instructors. How do you go about determining whether or not an instructor is qualified to teach the level of training you are seeking? What qualifications outside of basic NRA instructors courses would you recommend as an instructor have for training? So it's kind of a two-part question there.
Man. A training, so it depends what they're teaching, right? But if you're an instructor and you have not completed triple digits worth of private classes, so into the 100-hour or above range, you are probably not qualified to be an instructor, just flat out. If the only thing that you've got is a 20-hour, you know, NRA instructor, whatever, I don't think you're qualified to teach. And that's probably going to make people mad. But the reason why I say that is that you are limited at that point to whatever curriculum it is that you have gotten certified on. You have no deeper understanding of why that curriculum is set up the way that it is. You have you know, you have no understanding of other optional techniques. Honestly, you have no context to judge the instruction that you've just received. All that's happened is an instructor above you has regurgitated their information into your mouth like a baby bird, to use Will Petty's example, and you're gonna regurgitate whatever it is they've said. So you're a recording at that point. You're not an instructor. So I think the first thing that you need to do is cultivate the ability to critically think about things that are important inside of the shooting community, right? How do I judge whether or not someone can do that? Man, I don't know. I have conversations with them, but once again, that is determined off of me having a base level of knowledge to know whether or not I agree with what they're saying or how they're teaching. And the other issue too, and this is something that is kind of hard to swallow, but somebody can be a bad instructor and be giving bad information, and the students can still be better off than they would have been had they not gone and gotten bad instruction. And that's like, that's a realization I came to recently, very recently. It just like blew my mind. I had never considered that before, that maybe bad instruction was better than no instruction at all. You know,
depending.
Yeah, depending. And I'm not saying unsafe instruction. I'm saying bad instruction. There's a very clear delineation there.
Well, it may not be clear to some people. Maybe clear to us, but it may not be clear to other people.
Yeah, but I mean, so I don't know. Listen to the show. Ask questions of other instructors. Look at what best practices are, as far as see if there's a consensus. As far as if you're an instructor and you want to get better, go take a class with Tom Givens, one of the Rangemaster instructor classes. I want to say Mike Seeklander is doing instructor classes. Even Rob Pincus is doing instructor classes. And I don't agree with Rob on the shooting part, you know, and I've said as much. But I agree with Rob on the adult education part, and that is horribly overlooked inside of our industry. So, I mean, there's all these places that you can go and sort of like learn how to teach. And you need to learn how to shoot, too. And it involves going and taking shooting classes. Honestly, and you don't want to hear this probably, but if you want to actually become a good firearms instructor, that's going to cost you a lot of money. If you want to be a good, if you want to be a good one, you're talking $20,000 or $30,000 worth of education, realistically. Like, you know, if we're talking about over the course of years, I go and get X number amount of training, stuff like that. That's a lot of money and commitment. So just consider that.
And if you're looking at a potential instructor that maybe a class has come up and you're like, who is this person? How do I know? Definitely, if you can have a conversation with them, look at who they have trained with other than, you know, if they're only, hey, I have this class and my class was this and that's it, I'd be a little suspect of them. The other thing, too, is look for anything maybe that they've written. Everyone has a blog these days. Look for what they maybe have written, read it, even if it's just a Facebook page, so you can kind of see some of the stuff they're espousing or whatever. And read an article recently by, quote unquote, an instructor, and it was very filled with fluff. There was no real substance. There was no, like, this person has lots of training with a lot of different people, but there was no other instructor actually named, so you couldn't actually go back and check. There was no, you know, class specifically mentioned that was like, hey, I got this training from this particular class or an AAR of this. So it just, when you started adding all of those things together, it became very suspect. And it was just very, this person has a lot of fluffy things to say, but absolutely no substance behind them at all. And the further I dug, the more and more suspect it became, to the point where I'm just like, this person is absolutely, has no idea what they're talking about. And so that's kind of my record, kind of like weeding out fake news. You know, you just kind of got to keep digging, trust that gut. If something just doesn't seem right about a person, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's not, but trust your gut enough to go digging.
So we're coming up on the end of the show. I think we got time for one or two more. From Dakota Schaefer, What did you change your mind on over the past year?
That's interesting because I'm like, oh man, what has happened in the last year? I've changed my mind on a few different things. I changed my mind on what I felt was what I was able to carry, perhaps. What I was able to actually get away with. And you asked me 6 months ago if I could carry it weapon mounted, light concealed. I would have been like, are you out of your mind? Yet I have been for the last, 2 months now? Somewhere around there. Same with, I think I've changed my mind about the importance, and I can't remember if this has been within the last year or 2 years, the importance of carrying a spare magazine on my person all the time. Doesn't mean that I don't carry one, but just having it on my person, much more likely to have a flashlight on my person than a spare magazine. The importance of OC spray, while I still had like that mindset, like it is important, more and more emphasis on actually having it just as accessible as my gun or my knife or my flashlight. So instead of it being like this optional tool, which I kind of can have anywhere, having that definitely more accessible. So those are maybe some of the things I've changed in the last year.
Nice. We only got about a minute and 20 seconds.
What about
you? Yeah, we got about a minute and 20 seconds left. I'd say the biggest thing that I have changed my mind on in the last year is that, frankly, if I have an opinion about something, that I need to give it to that person. So, and I know that sounds really odd, but I've come to the conclusion that unless someone's asking me for my opinion, I'm not going to give it to them. And even then, I'm going to think real hard about it until we get to the point where they're paying me for my opinion. It's about the only way that I'm gonna get there these days. But anyway, that's it. That's the end of the show. So make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. And hey, keep leaving those 5-star review on iTunes. We really appreciate it. It helps us out. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe. See you next week.